The first case for oral argument this morning is Christopher J. Austin, appellant versus the South Dakota Board of Pardons and Paroles, appellees. For the appellant, Austin, we have Mr. Jason Shanks, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee board, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Shanks, you may proceed and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Gilbertson, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Shanks. I'm here representing appellant inmate Christopher J. Austin on his appeal of the Board of Pardons and Paroles decision stemming from his alleged violation of his suspended sentence supervision agreement and the trial court's upholding of such decision. Mr. Austin is currently serving a 10-year sentence on a grand theft charge with 6 years being suspended. His term is currently set to expire on January 9th of 2011, and his suspended sentence term was set to begin on January 9th of 2005. On December 11th of 2004, Mr. Austin submitted a kite to his mental health counselors. Subsequent to that submission, on January 5th of 2005, counselors Tom Gilchrist and Don Baum requested that Mr. Austin meet with them to discuss the kite, and Mr. Gilchrist also wanted to obtain additional information in order to file a petition for emergency commitment prior to Mr. Austin's release to suspended sentence. It was during that January 5th meeting that Mr. Austin allegedly made statements threatening to kill his parole officer. Following that meeting, Mr. Austin was wrote up for DOC rule infractions, and subsequently...
When you say allegedly, what did the trial court find? Statements were made or not made?
I believe the board held that the statements were in fact made.
Okay, the trial court affirmed that.
Yes, they did.
All right.
He was wrote up for the violations, and subsequently he was alleged to have violated his suspended sentence based upon the same threats that were outlined in his meeting with the counselors.
Now, were these notes that he had taken, that he had written himself, where were they a part of? Were they part of the journal he kept? When did those surface?
The kite, Your Honor, I believe you're
was
referring
that
to.
Was part of the kite?
The kite, we believe, is what substantiated the meeting between the counselors and Mr. Austin. I believe that was the reason why Mr. Gilchrist decided that he needed to do an emergency commitment. It's our position that that was not the focus of the alleged violations of the suspended sentence. The counselors had the kite since December 11th. They took no action on the kite based upon those statements in the kite. We would submit that the violations are stemming from the threats against the parole officer, and that's the basis of the violations that are before the court today. Four issues were raised in front of the trial court, and the same issues that are raised here today in front of this court. The first, that the state failed to meet its burden of proof that the threats that were made were actually true threats. Second, that Mr. Austin's equal protection rights have been violated. Third, that the conditions placed upon him in the suspended sentence agreement were unreasonable prior to his release. And fourth, that the overall decision by the board and the upholding by the trial court was clearly erroneous in light of the testimony and the evidence on record. The first issue, Mr. Austin submits that the state did not meet its burden of proof regarding the alleged threat and that Mr. Austin's speech is protected by the First Amendment. The state has claimed that the true threat doctrine does not apply to inmates because an inmate's rights, First Amendment's rights, are limited. However, the state has failed to show that this limitation of rights excludes the application of the true threat doctrine. If you look at the CCH case, which is not an inmate case, But the facts, I believe, are applicable and on point here with the facts in the Austed case. We have an alleged threat to kill. The victim did not hear the alleged threat. There was no testimony from the alleged victim that they perceived there to even be a threat. And so applying that case to the facts of this case, we believe they're similar. We believe that an inmate should be afforded those rights unless it is proven that the true threat doctrine does not apply. When looking at the specific factors set forth by this court, the first factor is whether an objectively reasonable recipient would view the message as a threat. Now, the board retained a psychological expert, Dr. Robert Strahan, to look at the threat that was made in the meeting between Gilchrist and Don Baum and advised the board as to whether this was a risk to the public and to the parole officer.
I want you to just back up and tell me, which case do you think supports your theory that the true threat doctrine applies to somebody in the penitentiary?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that there's a case that we can specifically point to that says it applies to inmates. We believe that First Amendment rights apply to everyone, and then the limitations come from there, and unless they can show that the limitation includes the exclusion of the true threat doctrine, then it should apply. If you look at, I guess, People v. XRL CCH, which is 2002 South Dakota 113, that sets the standard, which we believe should be applied in this case. This is, we believe, a case of first impression, and so we can't really point the court towards a case directly on point.
Doesn't the board have a different, let me phrase it differently, isn't the whole exercise different when the board is primarily concerned about protecting the public? And if you have somebody with this gentleman's history making a statement that he's going to kill his parole officers, isn't that a whole different context than the true threat doctrine is usually used in?
Well, I think the purpose is to protect the alleged victim, and that's what the true threat doctrine, and I understand the board's part of their purposes.
It's the public, too. I mean, it's not just the right. parole officers. Somebody that makes these kinds of statements, I mean, you know what's going to happen if they ignore it.
Correct, and we're not suggesting that it be ignored, and it wasn't ignored in this case. Mr. Austed was violated on DOC rule regulations, and quite honestly, had the state decided to pursue alleged violations of his suspended sentence for criminal acts, I don't know if they could approve that, but that's a potential possibility they could have pursued. I guess I look at it, it's akin to a jury trial, and we've got a mental health inmate here who we brought in experts to testify to as to was this actually a true threat or not. This is not the run of the mill.
Why do you need an expert to testify if somebody says they're going to kill you, it's a true threat? I think first grader would figure that out, wouldn't they?
Well, not necessarily. I guess in this case, we've got mental health counselors who've been working with Mr. Austed for the 4 years that he was incarcerated. We've got a psychological expert that's come in and testified, and I believe they're all consistent and said this was the purpose of his statements, was to get placement at a mental health facility. In fact, he even told Dr. Strahan and Counselor Baum that was why he was doing this. He wanted to go to a mental health facility. He is a person that's been institutionalized since he was 12 or 13 years old. He's been on medications, antipsychotic and antidepressant medications, and that's the reason why he was seeking to have treatment. And that's the reason why we're suggesting that this was not a true threat.
Why couldn't someone infer, though, that if he's willing to make the threat in order to get into a mental health facility, that he'd be willing to act on that threat in order to continue his effort to get into the mental health facility?
Well, it's possible that they could infer that, but I think it's based on the set of circumstances and looking at the factors as outlined by this court in People XRL CCH, that when considering all the entire factual record and context in this case, this is an individual who was just seeking to get placement. There was no testimony on record that he actually had the intent to harm someone. And I believe that is one of the factors that you consider The parole officer never testified that he felt threatened. There's no testimony that he was even aware that a threat has been made. Even to this day, I guess we don't even know whether he's been notified that this threat has even been made. And therefore, based upon that testimony, we'd submit that his First Amendment rights should be upheld.
You mean he can run around and threaten to kill people with impunity as long as the purported victim doesn't know about it?
No. I don't believe that that's the case. Again, it comes down to you have to analyze the factors. Is this a person who has a propensity to harm individuals in the past? Is this a person who, if he's not a mental health inmate, should we be taking him maybe more seriously? What's the purpose of his statements? If he's just saying it because he's a mean guy and wants to hurt somebody, then yeah, let's take that more seriously. But if he's a mental health patient, inmate, who's making these statements to try to go to a facility because he's scared of getting out and doesn't have anywhere to go, then I think that changes the context.
What, now, an inmate doesn't have all the full First Amendment rights that a citizen out on the streets had, isn't that? I mean, they screen letters and all kinds of things that you wouldn't be able to do for just a normal person on the street. So is there a case that outlines what is a prisoner's First Amendment rights?
Well, I haven't found one. I know the state has cited to a number of cases that talks about limitations, but I don't think it specifically outlines here's the things that they don't have.
It becomes a case-by-case basis?
I believe so, and this is a case where we believe that the court can look at this, and if it doesn't want to make a broad ruling, it could rule in this particular case that it should have been applied, and we're asking this court to apply it in this case.
But what if we just said he had no First Amendment rights?
Well, I think that would be contradictory to some of the cases decided by this court that inmates do have rights, not only First Amendment rights, right to due process, right to have notice in the Smith versus Board of Pardons and Paroles case. And so, you know, I don't think just because someone becomes an inmate they lose all their rights, especially when we've got an inmate that was 5 days from being released back into society. You know, we have to take that into consideration that he had almost done the time that he was supposed to do and that he would have been under supervision in our community. Mr. Osted also submits that his equal protection rights have been violated. The first question in any equal protection rights case is, in this particular case, was Mr. Osted treated differently from other similarly situated inmates? The comparison in this case is between Mr. Osted as a suspended sentence inmate and who has signed a supervision agreement and all other suspended sentence inmates who have not. Now, the state would ask this court to compare only those inmates who are still retained in the penitentiary but have signed the supervision agreement but haven't been released yet. But we'd submit that that's basically just adding more people into the equal protection mix. You can't just say, well, we deny this person's equal protection rights. Well, if we throw another person into the mix and deny his rights, then it's okay. We're denying them equally. That's not the comparison. The comparison in this case is Mr. Osted signed the supervision agreement before his release, and then he was violated on DOC rules, whereas other inmates who have not signed that agreement, who are still incarcerated, who violate DOC rules.
Let's back up for a minute. Say that he's not, before the board or anything, he's just a plain old prisoner. Are you saying that he could make this kind of a threat to a guard and he couldn't be disciplined?
No. He could be disciplined by DOC rules. The parole board could bring suspended sentence violation claims based upon the trial court's judgment of the conviction terms. If he is found to have committed a criminal act, I believe under Graycheck, this court has said that he has given notice that he can't commit any criminal action. You could violate his suspended sentence based on that as well. We're not saying that you cannot violate an inmate prior to their release. I think that's clear under the law. What we're saying is that, and we're not even saying that you can't have an inmate sign the supervision agreement prior to his release. The whole purpose of having them do that is just so the parole services can get all their paperwork done and get him placed before he gets out. We're not contesting that. If they want to continue in that procedure, they can. But what we are contesting is that once he signs it, now they want it to become effective and subject him to all these additional rules and regulations that the other suspended sentence inmates are not subjected to.
But just a minute. I thought I heard you just concede that that an inmate who has not signed an agreement may have his suspended sentence revoked for violations inside the institution.
Yes.
And so if that's the case, then what's the difference whether they've signed an agreement or not?
The difference, Your Honor, is that they're not violent based upon terms and conditions outlined in a suspended sentence supervision agreement.
But the suspended sentence agreement just piggybacks back to the internal rules of the institution.
No.
It says that a violation of an institution rule is a violation of the get-out rule. That's what it says.
I think there's a distinction. I'm not saying that an inmate can be violated merely on DOC rules alone. I think you have to look back to the trial court's order then and determine whether the trial court said you can be violated for violation. Your suspended sentence can be violated for DOC rule violations.
Well, the trial court orders aren't that specific. They're open-ended.
Well, in this case, the trial judge, I think, actually said if you follow the rules of the parole officer.
But there's lots of them that don't. I mean, I'll concede. Yes. This was very specific, the order in this case. But I would suggest that's probably the exception. Most of suspended sentences don't have that kind of language.
Well, our distinction is if you look at the executive director of parole services, and what his testimony was is he testified that they are treated differently, that DOC rules violations do not amount to suspended sentence violations. And I think in part the reason why they don't is because the inmates who have not signed the suspended sentence supervision agreements are not given notice that those violations could be violations of their suspended sentence. And under Smith, we have to give them notice of what they're doing is going to amount to a suspended sentence violation. If we don't give them notice, then you can't proceed against them.
Well, Mr. Leitenberg testified not that it doesn't ever happen. He just said it doesn't usually happen.
Well, and the reason why he said that is a case in point, like a Graycheck circumstances where you proceed against a guy that does a criminal act within the institution, even though he hasn't signed a suspended sentence agreement, they still can proceed against people who commit criminal acts or commit acts that are in violation from those specified by the trial court. We also believe that, in summary, there isn't a legitimate reason as to why the state has to have this suspended sentence supervision agreement come in effect on the date that the inmate signs the agreement. Mr. Leitenberg testified, we can have it effective on the date of the release. Nothing prevents us from doing that. What's the difference between December 28th when Mr. Ostedt violates a DOC rule and December 29th when he signs this supervision agreement and then violates the rule? He's still incarcerated. Nothing's really changed. He hasn't been released. And so to that extent, we're asking that this court look at the procedures that are followed by parole services and direct them to, if they want to have these inmates sign the suspended sentence supervision agreements, that they come into effect when the inmate actually leaves. That will ensure that everyone is treated the same. No inmates are given preferential treatment as compared to other suspended sentence inmates. The third issue is conditions 12 and 14 do not believe are reasonable. Initially, we question whether the parole services has the right or the parole board can establish additional conditions prior to the inmate's release. The state has, on page 29 of its brief, stated It is well established that the parole board may impose conditions upon the release of the offender, and we believe the key language is upon the release.
You're suggesting they have no authority to put any limitations at all until he walks out the door?
Parole, yes, we're saying that they cannot place additional conditions upon an inmate prior to the inmate's release. Even the state's own case that they cite to in Turo versus Solem states that the board's authority to place additional restrictions is on, quote, on the release. And we would ask this court to hold to that, and because they don't have the authority, that they're also unreasonable. In light of these arguments, we believe that the board's decision should be reversed.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Gagan, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. As you well know, the present appeal stems from a kite, which was written by Austin on December 11th of 2004, in which he stated to prison officials, if you want to know what goes on through my everyday thoughts, here you go. These are what my true thoughts are. Attached to that kite were several handwritten pages containing what the circuit court described as graphic and violent details of Austin's fantasies, how he wanted to kill and torture unidentified victims. Those descriptions in the circuit court's view were very disturbing and brutal, and included how Austin would mutilate his victims and eat their various bodily parts.
What part did that play? Supposedly, they did not violate him on those particular writings.
I think it has to be considered in conjunction with the subsequent threats. There's no question that that kite is what prompted mental health staff to meet with Austin on January 5th to, I believe what the testimony was, clarify the information they had written.
But it's the threat to the parole officer that really caused this action, correct?
I think, like I said, you have to consider it all in conjunction, the entire surrounding factual scenario.
And we don't know for sure what the board did, do we? Whether they considered that material, because they don't make findings of fact.
No. Like I was indicating earlier, that meeting was an apparent attempt to determine whether the threats in question were genuine or perhaps whether Austin had some other motive in writing the kite. Austin not only admitted to writing the kite, but when asked what would happen if he were to be released in prison, Austin told Gilchrist and Baum, if I get out on the street, you better hope I don't pick up a gun. He then proceeded to boast how he would kill his parole officer, assassination style, by putting two bullets in the back of his skull. Austin also told Gilchrist and Baum how he would kill several other people as well, before eventually taking his own life. According to Austin, if he was ever sent back to prison, it would be on death row. Based on those threats, a violation report was written up on January 6th, alleging that Austin had violated conditions of his suspended sentence agreement. Specifically, he was said to have violated conditions number 12 and conditions number 14 of that agreement. Condition number 14 prohibited Austin from engaging in any assaultive, aggressive, or violent behavior, including the making of any threats of violence. Under condition number 12, Austin admitted to understanding that a violation of institutional rules prior to his release would also be considered a violation of his suspended sentence agreement. Austin later elected to waive his rights before the disciplinary committee and admitted to having committed the prohibited acts charge. Specifically, the state would direct this court's attention to page 3 of the circuit court's memorandum decision, where the court found, and I quote, the records indicate that Austin verbally admitted to the prohibited acts charged and accepted the sanctions but refused to sign the disciplinary document.
Now, there's a challenge that that's clearly erroneous. Where in the record did she is there basis for that finding?
There was a...
That he admitted.
There was an institutional document where Austin had waived his right to appear before the disciplinary committee and contest.
So it's assumed from that he admitted it.
Right. There's a blank on there, I believe, that was checked, indicating that he admitted to the violation, accepted the sanctions imposed, i.e. 90 days of disciplinary segregation, but Austin, for whatever reason, refused to actually sign the document when asked to do so by prison officials.
Now, your opposing counsel suggested that inmates do retain some First Amendment rights. Do you agree with that? And if so, what rights or how much do they retain?
I believe, based on prior case authority, they do retain a minimum level of the constitutional rights, but again, they're not absolute. Those rights must be balanced against legitimate penological objectives such as rehabilitation, internal security, deterrence of further crime.
So you would say there's no bright line rule?
There's no bright line test, exactly.
Okay.
In this particular case, the state would submit that they had a valid interest in permitting or prohibiting, excuse me, such threatening behavior on the part of the inmates as part of an attempt to rehabilitate the inmate. Before getting to the specific arguments raised by Austin on appeal, the state would like to take just a brief moment to comment on the appropriate standard of review. In his brief, Austin argues that the burden of proof is by a preponderance of the evidence. With all due respect to counsel, the state would submit that that's not the correct standard. This court has said on repeated occasions that the standard of review in a probation revocation case is simply whether the evidence is sufficient to reasonably satisfy the trier of fact that the defendant's conduct has not been as good as required by the conditions of his probation. So long as there's evidence in the record to support this minimal level of scrutiny, it cannot be said that the parole board abused its discretion revoking Austin's suspended sentence. With that in mind, the first issue the state would like to address is Austin's arguments that his statements were not threats at all, but were instead protected speech. He relies on this court's decision in People X Rel CCH, where the court adopted the two-threat doctrine and identified various factors that were to be considered in distinguishing between a threat and protected speech. The state, however, would submit that Austin's reliance on CCH is misplaced. The circuit court, in its memorandum decision, found that the true threat doctrine was not applicable in the Issen case. As noted by the circuit court, this court's analysis in CCH was in the context of a juvenile adjudication. Austin presented no citation to any authority where that analysis was extended to the prison setting. The circuit court, therefore, refused to extend this doctrine to the facts or scenario of the present case. Instead, the circuit court, in rejecting Austin's argument, started with a familiar and well-accepted proposition that lawful incarceration does bring about the necessary limitation of withdrawal of many rights and privileges of an inmate. Courts have recognized that when compared to other citizens, the rights and privileges of an inmate aren't the same. They're diminished. As I indicated earlier, it has to be balanced against legitimate penological objectives. Moreover, the circuit court, in its memorandum decision, found that the factors identified in CCH were just that, factors to be considered. They weren't required elements. Furthermore, the circuit court found that there's no indication that all of those factors must be satisfied before a statement would be considered a threat. Instead, this court indicated in CCH that the threat must be considered in light of the entire factual context, including the entire surrounding events as well as the reaction of the listeners. Here, testimony is presented before the parole board that both Gilchrist and Baum considered Austin's threats to be an obvious concern to the community if he were to be released on probation. Baum testified, and I quote, "Prison staff have to take such threats seriously. We're required to report a threat to others or himself." The entire factual history in this case includes a long history of violence on Austin's part. According to Baum, I think in looking back through his notes, there is just serious kinds of threats to staff, to officers on the floor on Unit A. There was additional testimony presented before the parole board that Austin had chronic episodes of aggression toward others. Now, despite Austin's apparent beliefs to the contrary, prison officials don't have to wait for problems to occur before addressing them. They're entitled to act preemptively in order to prevent problems from occurring in the first place. Now, Austin would apparently have this court believe that his threats were nothing more than a cry for help because he was fearful of being released out on the streets with nowhere to go. The state would submit that that argument ignores the testimony given by Dr. Strahan, who was retained by the parole board to evaluate Austin. Although Dr. Strahan indicated that Austin's threats may well have been an attempt to manipulate prison staff into transferring him to the Human Service Center, he did specifically testify, and I quote, "It may also be something that would indicate that he has certain fantasies that he has heretofore not spoken to that may very well present a substantial risk." According to Dr. Strahan, Austin would be prone to acting out his aggressions acting out his anxieties and frustrations in a physically aggressive manner. When asked if he had any opinion as to whether Ostedt should be released on probation, Dr. Strahan stated, as a matter of course, I don't intrude on the parole board's authority to address the ultimate issue. Dr. Strahan did testify, however, and I quote, it would be imprudent to go from a setting of administrative segregation to relative freedom without some demonstration of appropriate behavior prior to his release. Based on that, the state would submit that there's simply no merit to Austin's assertion that the parole board's decision, as well as that of the trial court, was clearly erroneous. There was no support in the record for Austin's assertion that the state failed to put on any evidence of his prior threatening behavior and that it therefore did not present a danger to anybody. The state would once again submit that Ostedt's disciplinary record speaks for itself. That record shows that Ostedt had a long history of acting out while at the institution. There were numerous kinds of threats to staff. Despite being directed several times to clean up his write-ups, Ostedt continued to threaten staff members.
Was he disciplined for these previous threats?
Exactly. If you look at the record, the vast majority of time that Ostedt has been incarcerated has been spent housed in administrative or disciplinary segregation.
So apparently his record indicates that his previous threats were treated as serious by people that run the pen.
Right, exactly. As I've indicated earlier, prison officials are trained to treat those threats seriously. They're required to report those and file an information report, which is exactly what they did in this particular case.
Now, you've made reference to psychiatric testimony. Do you think that that is necessary in a case like this?
No, but I think it goes to show that the board went above and beyond this particular case in an attempt to determine, okay, what's the motive for writing these threats? Okay, were they genuine, or was it some sort of an attempt to manipulate the system in securing his transfer to the Human Services Center?
Who has the burden of proof as to whether or not it's a true threat?
In this particular case, I think, like I said earlier, the standard proof before the parole board is whether the individual, in this particular case, the parole board who filed the violation report, can show that there's evidence to reasonably satisfy the trier of fact, i.e. the parole board, that his conduct wasn't as good as required by the conditions of his probation.
So it's not a beyond a reasonable doubt, it's not clear and convincing, it's not a preponderance of the evidence, just
no.
Reasonably satisfied.
This court in numerous cases said it's
like
reasonably
he's
satisfied.
As good as he should have been.
And refer to it as a minimal level of scrutiny. The other issue the state would like to briefly touch on here today is Ostedt's assertion that his equal protection rights were violated. According to Ostedt, he was treated differently than other inmates with suspended sentences because unlike those inmates who had not signed their agreements, he faced the revocation of probation. The first question this court must look at is whether Ostedt was in fact similarly situated to all other inmates serving suspended sentences. The state would submit that the answer is no. There is a critical difference between those inmates who have signed a supervision agreement and those who have not. In the case of the former group of inmates, they're put on notice as to the conditions they must comply with. Even if it could be said for sake of argument that Ostedt was similarly situated, the state would submit that he's still not shown any discriminatory intent on the part of the state. This court has said in the past that a defendant asserting an equal protection violation must do more than show that the state's actions had a discriminatory effect. He must also show a discriminatory motive or intent. In its memorandum decision, the circuit court in this case found that Ostedt failed to show that it was purposely treated any differently than other inmates. According to the circuit court, a few isolated examples on unequal treatment are simply not sufficient to support a finding of class-wide purposeful discrimination. Finally, the state would submit that Ostedt has not shown that a strict scrutiny analysis should be applied in the present case. As indicated in the state's brief, constitutional rights that might otherwise receive a strict scrutiny analysis are reviewed under a lesser standard in the context of a prison setting. Even if an inmate's constitutional rights are impinged, a prison regulation will be upheld provided it is reasonably related to a legitimate penological objective.
How do you arrive at what the class is that we should be comparing him with? Or what class does he fall in?
The state would submit that the class of all inmates serving suspended sentences is too broad because the record shows that there are a number of inmates who are nowhere near their scheduled release date, so they haven't been asked to sign any agreement. The reason being that time changes things. Okay, what may be true today may not be true tomorrow, i.e. inmates propose employment, source of income, proposed residence. The parole board likes to have information as current as possible. That's why there was testimony record that typically an inmate is asked to sign a suspended sentence agreement anywhere between 15 and 30 days prior to a scheduled release. As part of the process, the inmate also has to submit a release plan, which is included, like I've indicated, his proposed employment, source of revenue, what have you. There was testimony and record that the inmate's actual release from prison may be delayed depending upon a variety of factors, including a delay by the inmate in submitting a release plan or ultimate approval by the parole board of that release plan. There was testimony and record that for whatever reasons, the release plan may simply fall through. One final matter the state would like to address is OSTA's assertion that the supervision agreement should go into effect only upon the inmate's release. The state would submit that such a position is not only illogical, it violates strong public policy. This court has said that if an inmate or a defendant is granted a suspended sentence and should demonstrate that he's not worthy of the suspension, the parole board has the authority to revoke the probation both before and during the terms of the suspension. The rationale is quite simple. Courts have said that a defendant should demonstrate by his conduct that he's unworthy of the suspension. He cannot be allowed to engage in that conduct with impunity. Courts have said, and I quote, to hold otherwise would make a mockery of the very philosophy underlying the concept of probation, namely that given a second chance to live within the rules of society, one will prove that he can do so and therefore become a productive member. The state would submit that threatening to torture, kill, and mutilate unidentified victims as well as assassinating one's parole officer hardly demonstrates that OSTA was capable of living within the rules of society and hence deserving of a suspended sentence. Now, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would close by simply asking.
I have a question on the, when you compare, if we accept Osted's argument and that all of them should be required to sign the release agreement closer or at the time they leave. In this case, then, he would have been treated differently had he not signed the release. Are you agreeing with that?
There was testimony and record.
That would have just been an internal disciplinary action as opposed to a suspended sentence action.
Osted's argument, I believe, is premised on the testimony of Ed Lightberg, who was asked specifically if someone has not signed a suspended sentence agreement and they violate DOC rules, do you impose a suspended sentence violation? Lightenberg's response to that question was, no, normally we do not do that.
Well, isn't that a problem then, that he's treated differently because he was required to sign this 2 weeks ahead of time?
The rationale being, the reason the inmates asked to sign a supervision agreement so they can be put on notice under this court's decisions in Smith and Robinson.
So then you think they are treated differently, but there's a reason for it? Is that what you're saying?
The category of all suspended sentence inmates, it's too broad. The state would submit you have to break it down into two categories, those that have signed the agreement and those that have not.
And therein is the difference in the argument.
Therein is the difference. And even if you assume they're similarly situated, the state has a rational basis for asking that this inmate sign a supervision agreement prior to his release.
Let's assume they are similarly situated. All the inmates that are awaiting to be released for suspended sentence, whether they've signed it or not. Let's assume that's the class. Now, what's your argument then that supports
that he still hasn't shown any discriminatory motive or intent on the part of the state? As indicated in the state's brief, this court has said that a defendant asserting an equal protection violation must do more than show a discriminatory effect. He has to show a discriminatory intent or motive. In this particular case, the circuit court found that Austin had not shown that he was purposely treated any differently. The court said that a few isolated examples of unequal treatment don't support a finding of class-wide discrimination. The circuit court found there was a legitimate basis for why the parole board asked the inmate to sign the suspended sentence agreement when it did. So unless there's any further questions, they would simply ask that this court affirm the parole board's decision to revoke Austin's suspended sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Gegan. Mr. Shanks, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I have three or four responses. First, I'll concede that the standard is, I believe, a reasonably satisfied standard, but that's a decision by the board. It doesn't change the standard of review on the legal issues and the application of the law to the facts. That is still going to be de novo, And therefore, when reviewing the appeal issues here today, we're asking this court to review de novo and determine in its own mind whether Mr. Ostedt violated the terms and conditions of his suspended sentence. In regard to the kite, again, if you look at the record, the actual violation report that was filed, condition 14 specifically references the threat to the parole agent, noting him by name and talking about specific statements about shooting him. In addition, we believe that the focus of the board hearing was on the allegations made against the parole officer, and if the state is unable to prove a threat against someone who's specifically identified, then we would submit that it's even more difficult to prove against the public in general, even if you are going to consider the kite.
Well, you know, if you look at instances like Columbine and that, the law enforcement were just castigated after the fact for not taking action on threats that were made prior to the event. And some of those threats were a lot more vague than what we've got here, which is basically, I'm going to kill so-and-so, and here's how I'm going to do it. Sounds like they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Well, I think that when Ostedt is released, we're not just cutting him out into society with no precautions. As stated by Mr. Gilchrist, he was in the process of doing an emergency commitment to a mental health institution so that that would not happen, so that he would get the treatment necessary, the treatment that he wanted. Parole services can place restrictions on inmates, specifically sending them to halfway houses or to HSC. They can put curfew restrictions on. They can take steps to protect society without trampling on their rights. In regard to the statements by Mr. Baum indicating that there was serious threats to staff in the past, he also stated in the record that that his account of that those were hearsay, and that he didn't have, I believe, substantiated information or documentation to that effect. That was only his recollection. But he did, and even if that is considered, I think it only bolsters Mr. Ostedt's claim that his equal protection rights were violated. If, in fact, there was 100 prior alleged violations or threats to staff, why wasn't his suspended sentence violated then? The reason is because he hadn't signed a suspended sentence supervision agreement yet. And the second that he signed that and became subject to the terms and conditions of that, that's only the only reason why they went in and violated his parole or his suspended sentence. In regard to the state's argument that the class should be those who have been who have signed the agreement and have been given notice, just because they're been given notice and their due process rights arguably have been satisfied, that still does not resolve the equal protection issue. Regardless of whether they get notice or not, they're still held to different standards or different punishments for the same actions. It doesn't solve the problem simply by telling
them. Are they really, though? If you look at Graycheck, he had not signed a release, and yet that we approved of the revocation of a suspended sentence there.
Correct, Your Honor, but Graycheck is different because criminal acts, whether you sign an agreement or not, are going to be found to have been a violation of their suspended sentence. What I'm talking about is DOC rule violations, and if we have an inmate who is insubordinate.
So you're saying is if they would have charged this out as a assault or something, attempted assault or whatever, then we've got a different.
We'd have a totally case. Different, and I would have defended my case differently, Your Honor. In essence, the signing of the suspended sentence agreement is different from having it become effective. The state has argued, well, we need him to sign it. Fine, we'll sign it. There's a difference between signing and having it become effective. The parole services is not affected if we have this agreement become effective when the inmate walks out the door. He can sign it a month before he goes out. He can sign it 6 months before he goes out. All we're asking is that it only become effective when he leaves. Department of Corrections is not affected by this. They can still go on their day-to-day operations, disciplining inmates for statements made. If they want to put them in segregation for alleged threats and punish them within the system under their rules, they can do so. So we're not actually asking that anything be substantially changed in the way things operate. As far as a day-to-day operation in the prison system, what we're asking is that once they sign the agreement, that it only become effective when they leave. And if the court has any further questions, I have.
I guess not. Thank you, Mr. Shanks. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.